Thank you, Jeff. I got some cheap tickets to sell if anybody needs any. I'm Larry Grantham, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. By God's grace in this program, especially the 12 steps and the principles contained therein, that I'm sober tonight. And it's Saturday night. Whoa! You should not be sober on Saturday night. It's good to be here. We got a little housekeeping chores we have to do first. You know, we got to thank Bill and the committee, and such a privilege to be a part of the 9th Annual Midwinter Conference here. And Jess, thank you. You know, Jess told me on the phone, Jess is a man of few words. I knew when he got up here he was not going to give me a long, elaborate introduction. Because he called me on the phone, first time I ever heard from him, and he said, I'm your host. I got your itinerary. I'll meet you at the airport. Bye. He called back a few minutes later, and he said, I forgot to tell you how you'll identify me. I'll have on some Oklahoma Sooner outfit. When I got off that plane, there was 50 people meeting other people that had Oklahoma Sooner outfits on. On my 50th try, I introduced myself to 49 other people before I found Jess. And all it was, I knew him immediately when I saw him because he's standing over there by himself not saying a word to nobody. But you know, this thing kicked off real well last night. And I was glad to see Pat up here, although, you know, Pat talked about being a blackout drinker. And I couldn't really identify with her, even though I was a blackout drinker from the very start. And I drank all over the country. And so that meant I drank some in California. And she said she came to one morning with a sailor in her bed, and I had never done that. And then we moved along there, and we had Marianne get up here, and then we had Babs. And, you know, I'm grateful for Al-Anon and the American family, I mean, the Al-Anon family groups and the Al-Ateens and Al-Tots and all this stuff. But I don't want them to get too big-headed. But they got to remember, we the ones that got them here. The Babs did a great job. And then this afternoon, of course, my buddy Kip, you know, I don't know, it's not a whole lot I can say about Kip. He just gets up here and pours his heart out, and that's really what this thing's all about. But it's been a great weekend, you know. For the people that has the red star on your badge, and it's your first conference, you know, if your motor's not revved up by now, you know, mine's been revved up since Pat kicked it off last night for me, and I hope your motor's revved up, and I hope you're going full speed with Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what'll save your life. It'll give you a new life. And you know, it's given me all those things. Let's see if I made any more notes on this. Oh yeah, the one thing that I think the thread that was woven between all the people that's been up here behind this microphone so far is the honesty. You know, I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous now. My sobriety date is May the 25th of 1986. My home group is the State Line Group. And the reason we call it the State Line Group is because it's on State Line Road almost right between Tennessee and Mississippi. So it qualifies to be a state line, and that's my group. And I'm in good standing there. I was there Tuesday night. And well, I wasn't this past Tuesday. I was out of town. But I'm usually, when I'm in town, I'm there every Tuesday and every Friday night. We meet Tuesdays and Fridays. So I'm in good standing. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous at the State Line Group. But, you know, our sobriety is very important to us, and I'm a native Mississippian. Oh, by the way, I did forgot to tell y'all one thing. I want to congratulate the Oklahoma Sooners on being number one in the nation this year. What a thrill, what a great victory they had in the Orange Bowl. And as I get on with this talk, I'm sure you'll understand why I'm so involved in that kind of stuff. But, you know, I made a big sacrifice this weekend. Y'all do realize that tomorrow is the AFC and NFC championship games, and I'll be traveling, you know. I hope my VCR tape works back home, because I'll certainly be taping those. So I made somewhat of a sacrifice to get out here to see all y'all. But I'm a native Mississippian. I live at Horn Lake, Mississippi now, but I was born and raised down outside from a little town outside of Jackson, Mississippi, Crystal Springs. And I didn't even know what a native Mississippian was until I got sober and somebody defined it for me. That to be a native Mississippian, Mississippi is composed of 82 counties. And you got to have gotten drunk in all 82 counties to be a native. So I'm a native Mississippian. I actually grew up outside Crystal Springs, Mississippi, out in the country. And y'all, a lot of you are too young, but some of you are old enough to remember. Back in those days, we didn't have indoor plumbing out there where I lived, and we didn't have running water. We had a house out behind our house that we used, and we got our water out of a well. And we didn't have any of this modern stuff, and that wasn't good enough for me. I got five brothers and sisters. I come from a big family. I got three older sisters, and then I'm the boy in there, and then two younger brothers. So I'm the middle child, kind of the oldest boy. And when I got sober in Alcoholic Anonymous, I'm sure y'all probably thought along the same lines, I wanted to find out why I'm an alcoholic. There was no alcoholism in my home. My dad didn't drink, and we were churchgoers. We were Southern Baptists. Matter of fact, we were such Southern Baptists, we prayed for Catholics. So there was no alcohol around my home, and I wanted to find out why I was an alcoholic. Now, this is before I got a sponsor that told me that I needed to know why I was an alcoholic, there'd be a chapter in the big book called Why You're an Alcoholic. And there's no chapter in there called Why You're an Alcoholic. Evidently, you don't need to know. But I thought I needed to know. And I started looking back through my childhood. Now, I did grow up real, real poor. And I mentioned I had three older sisters. And when you got to wear hand-me-down clothes to school, that might give you a good reason, you know. But I don't think that's the reason I'm standing there. I really didn't have to wear their clothes to school. I was only kidding. But I don't think that's the reason I'm standing out behind this speaker stand tonight. You see, I was ashamed of the way I was raised. I don't know where any of the rest of y'all were ashamed of your mother and dad and the way you were raised tonight, because we were raised so far out in the country, and my family worked they were kind of sharecroppers, and I didn't like that. And I had a little bit of athletic ability. And so I wanted to get out of the environment I was raised in. So at an early age, I had all them character defects that we got here many years later with, but, you know, I was a thief, and I was a cheat, and I was a liar, and I was a con artist, but I had a little bit of athletic ability, and I started working on this at an early age. And sure enough, when I graduated from high school, the University of Mississippi, which, by the way, Oklahoma's awful lucky they didn't have to play Ole Miss again, didn't they? But we're the last team that beat y'all, you know, in the Shreveport Bowl a year ago, but, I mean, you know, Ole Miss did win the ballgame. But Ole Miss came down and offered me a scholarship to come up there to play football and baseball. They said I was too small to play football, but they'd give me a half scholarship in football and half in baseball. And the reason they gave me a scholarship is because I had good grades in high school. I was a leader. I was captain of the football team and president of the student body and made good grades, and because I did everything. I was trying to please my folks, even though I wanted to get away from them. And so I took off to Oxford, Mississippi, 200 miles north of where I was raised, to go to college. But you see, I had some primary purposes in my life that very few people knew about. Since there was no alcohol in my home, and back then the liquor, I think Oklahoma and Mississippi were the last two states to ever declare liquor legal. I think we were the last dry states. And Mississippi was dry at the time I grew up, so we'd heard about homebrew, and I'd heard a little bit about White Lightning and stuff like that, but I'd never drank any of it. So I didn't know anything about alcohol. When I had this primary purpose, I wanted to learn about alcohol. Because the man of the world, you know, the macho man, the John Wayne thing we hear about here in Alcoholic Anonymous, you know, I heard a story the other day about the John Wayne thing, you know, the local supermarket there where we live had a contest going. They had come up with some new toilet tissue, and they wanted somebody to name it. Had a big contest. It was stacked up all over the store. And finally, this little lady came back in there, a little elderly lady with white hair, and she said, I can name that toilet tissue. So we bought some and tried it. I can name it for you. The store owner said, well, what would you name it? She said, John Wayne. He said, John Wayne? Why would you name toilet tissue after John Wayne? She said, because it's rough and tough and don't take crap off of nobody. So that's kind of what I wanted, you know, the John Wayne, the macho man. I figured I need to learn about drinking. So the first time we had any time off after I got to college, I was 17 and a half years old, and first time we had any free time, I got with the other guys, older upperclassmen, the older football players, and we went up through to Memphis, Tennessee. We was headed to West Memphis, Arkansas to do some partying. And I went in a liquor store. They had liquor stores in Tennessee at the time, and I went into a liquor store, and I'd never been in a liquor store in my life. I was a complete rookie about buying booze. I didn't know the difference between beer, or bourbon, or vodka, or wine, or gin, or anything. And I looked around that store, and I had a very limited budget. Didn't have much money to spend. And I looked around that store, and my eyes fell on a gallon of Mogan David wine. And I had enough money to buy it, so I bought it. And I carried it back out that car we were in. Back in those days, we had paper cups, and we had ice. And I took that ice and put in that paper cup, and I poured that Mogan David wine over it, and I drank it right on down. Standing up here before you all tonight, I can remember that exact feeling, that first drink of wine, the first drink of alcohol I ever had in my life. I can know the exact feeling of what it did to me. You know, it kind of burned going down through your throat and down through your esophagus and got down there and hit your stomach and kind of churned it up a little bit and made your stomach feel a little rosy, you know, and your fingers started to tingle a little bit. Your toes started to kind of curl up a little bit, you know, and well, it kind of felt like you swallowed an umbrella and opened up on the inside of it, you know. I put that keen mathematical mind of mine to work, and I figured out if one cup of wine would make me feel that good, two cups of wine would make me feel twice that good. So I drank that second cup of wine, and sometime between that second cup of wine, and we went on over to West Memphis, Arkansas to party, and they had some joints up and down the river and dancing and bands and... But sometime between the second cup of wine and the end of the evening, all the classic symptoms of alcoholism was present in my life the first time I drank alcohol. I found out when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book says, men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It doesn't say alcoholics, it says men and women. That's the first symptom of alcoholism, of course, is drinking alcohol. And then somewhere in there in the big book in chapter 3, I found out that it tells us, defines alcoholic, the definition that I've come to love so well. It says alcoholic simply is men and women who's lost the ability to control their drinking. It don't say when you lost it, how old you were, where you lost it, how you lost it. It says you lost the ability to control your drinking. And it goes on to tell us that no alcoholic will ever regain control. And it compares us to men that lose their legs. They won't grow new legs. Neither will an alcoholic regain control of alcoholism. So that's two of the symptoms. Then I blacked out. That's another symptom. And I passed. And I got in trouble. And I passed out. 30 years later, all of this happened when I was 17 and a half years old, my first year at college. I got sober when I was 47 and a half years old, 30 years later. Last time I drank alcohol, I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. Once I drank that alcohol, I couldn't control the amount of alcohol I put in my body, so I'd lost control, never did have control, and I blacked out, and I got in trouble, and I passed out. So I didn't really progress a whole heck of a lot in this thing throughout 30 years. But I didn't come to the next morning when I came to and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 17 and a half years old. I was in college. And, you know, our friends started telling us what we did last night in that blackout and how cute it was. And, you know, we all thought that was something. And I didn't go to my friends and say, because I was sick the next morning. You drink Mogan David wine and drink as much as I did. You're pretty well sick the next morning. But I didn't go to my friends and say, you know, I drank something last night that damn near killed me, and I can't wait to do that again. Just didn't do that. And I made up my mind the next day that I could drink alcohol if I drank the right amount and if I stayed away from Mogan David wine. Of course, you know, that's a decision, and I've never been good at decisions. Kept out of decision to make about whether I need to go to the bathroom or not. Before I got up here tonight, it looks like I made the wrong decision. No. Never been good at decisions. But the 4 years when I was in college are probably the best 4 years of your life. You know, you have very little responsibilities. And Ole Miss back in those days was a football factory, and all I had to do was be able to play football, and everything else was taken care of. In the 4 years, 3 years that we were able to play football at Ole Miss, not because of me, because we had a great team. We went to 3 bowl games at the end of the year for rewards for having great teams. Went to Sugar Bowl twice and the Gator Bowl once. And my senior year, now back in those days, you played both ways. You played offense and defense. And my senior year, our team gave up, scored 327 points in 11 ball games. And we gave up a total of 21 points in 11 ball games. And I was very fortunate. I made All-American, All-Southeastern Conference and all that stuff. And, oh, yeah, while I was there, Ole Miss had back-to-back Miss Americas. And I dated both of them. That ain't got a damn thing to do with drinking or football. I wasn't for y'all to know that I dated them good-looking women. ...1960 rolled around. I was graduating from college, and all at once, my phone started ringing. And there was this thing called professional football. Now, y'all got to remember, this is late 50s and then 1960, and TV wasn't nearly about as good as it is now. We didn't have all this stuff and cable, and you know, we just barely could see the images on that screen jumping around. I mean, TV wasn't a whole lot. So I'd never been to a pro football game. All the pro football teams were up north and out west and places like that. They had none in the south. And so they started calling. The Baltimore Colts called me and they said, "We got your rights. We drafted you." I was trying to get out of school and go make a few dollars because I hadn't been broke all the time I'd been in college. And then all at once, New York called and said, "We're starting a brand new league in 1960. We're going to play in the fall of 1960, and we drafted you. And we got your rights in the American Football League." So they came. I had a representative from each team to come down to Oxford, Mississippi, where Ole Miss is. And I sat down in the middle, and they'd sit one on one side and one on the other, and they started talking about money. And they started talking about some money to sign your name. Ain't nobody ever given me nothing to sign my name before. So I got very interested in that bonus. And all at once, they started piling that money up there on the table. And it got up to $1,000, and I'd never seen $1,000 in one pile in my entire life. And I took off, and I signed a contract and took off to New York City to play professional football, never having seen a game. You know, y'all, some of y'all old enough to remember old Andy Griffith. He had a record out about this time. He called it "What It Is Football." And all through the record, he was trying to figure out what the object of the game was. And finally, at the end of the record, he figured it out. The object of football was to take the ball and get from one end of the cow pasture to the other without either falling down or stepping in something. And that's about all I knew about professional football when I took off to New York City. And I've been visiting back there in the smoking room. I'm a smoker. I wish I could say that everybody here tonight is going to stay sober the rest of their life. That's not what the odds say is going to happen. So if you hadn't found a place you drink that they don't serve it as fast as you like it served, or as long as you like it served, or the way you like it served, you might try New York City. Them people up there understand alcohol, and I can tell you. They call them things restaurants. They got them all up and down that concrete jungle up there. And they call themselves restaurants, but I believe some of them's menu only has Slim Jims and crackers and a lot of booze on them. But for the next 13 years, I pursued a career that I really don't have the vocabulary to get up here and describe to you. When you're playing pro football in the largest city in the world, New York City, and you get in a cab and you go downtown and people want your autograph and the cab driver wants a picture and autograph and tickets to the game and you go in and people buy you food and booze and, you know, it just, it does something for your ego is really what it does. If you remember the history of football, you know, the two leagues were separate. The American Football League was over here, the National Football League was over here, and they hated each other. Matter of fact, they tried to draft the same player coming out of college, and they bid for his services, and the money started getting on up there pretty good. And then they started getting people jump from one league to the other league, and they started fighting. And finally, they decided that the only way to handle this thing was to get together and play one game for the championship of professional football. And somebody coined the phrase Super Bowl. So the first Super Bowl was ever played was played in January of 1967. And the Green Bay Packers won the National Football League. The Oakland Raiders won the American Football League. I mean, the Kansas City Chiefs won the American Football League. They played the first Super Bowl was ever played, and Green Bay beat the hell out of Kansas City. 1968 came around again. The Green Bay Packers won the National Football League. This time it was Oakland Raiders who won the American Football League. They played in Super Bowl II. Green Bay beat the hell out of Oakland. So the National Football League was 2-0, and everybody started talking about the Mickey Mouse League being the American Football League, and that's the league we were in, and had a lot of derogatory terms to call us. And finally, in December of 1968, we played the Oakland Raiders in Shea Stadium. The New York Jets played the Oakland Raiders in Shea Stadium for the championship of the American Football League, and for the right to go to Super Bowl III. And we beat the Raiders that night, 27-23. Real tough ballgame. That same day, Cleveland played Baltimore at Cleveland, at Cleveland's home park. And Baltimore beat Cleveland 34-0 for the championship of the National Football League for the right to go to Super Bowl III. And so right away the next day, all the odds makers, all the smart people, they made the Baltimore Colts 19.5-point favorites over the New York Jets in Super Bowl III. Well, I'm sure y'all know what our attitude was about that, you know, that ego we had. Matter of fact, that young quarterback we had named Joe Namath from Alabama from Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, went to school in Alabama. He got behind a speaker stand such as this on Tuesday night when we were down in Miami working out and getting ready to play the Super Bowl on Sunday. And some drunk in the back row told him, said he, I think Joe was accepting an award, and this drunk, probably one of us that hadn't got the Alcoholics Anonymous yet, stood up and said, oh, Joe, why don't you sit down and shut up? Baltimore's going to kick your butt on Sunday. Off the top of his head, Joe said, no, the Jets are going to win the game. I guarantee it. Well, the next morning, we wake up, and the headlines all over the nation, and all the newspapers and TV says, Namath guarantees Jet victory, and here we are, 19.5-point underdog, you know. And I don't know what y'all do if you go in a room where there's a Doberman laying over there sleeping. I don't know where you go over and kick him to wake him up, see if he'll bite you, but that's what we felt like Joe had done, but... We went out this Sunday afternoon, and sure enough, we beat Baltimore 16-7, and we became the first American Football League team to ever win a Super Bowl. Things started happening in my life and started changing right away. The day after Super Bowl, we went back to New York City, largest city in the world. They had a ticker tape parade down Madison Avenue and Fifth Avenue, and we were riding in open-air convertibles, and they're throwing that confetti out of those high-rise office buildings, and boy, my mind tells me it don't get no better than this. I have arrived. I have proved to everybody back down in that little hometown that I can make something out of my life and I could beat somebody. Sure enough, January the 23rd of 1969, the state of Mississippi had a Larry Grantham Day and proclaimed by the governor, and my hometown gave me a banquet and a parade and honored me and my family, and I said, man, it don't get no better than this. I have arrived. You know, there's a lot of funny things that happen along the way in football. 3 years into football, I wanted my mother to come to New York because at Thanksgiving up there, they have that cornbread dressing. They have white bread dressing. They don't have cornbread dressing like we have down south here. And so I wanted my mother to come up here and make some cornbread dressing for me. She got off that airplane. She had a pan about that big around. She was going to make dressing for everybody on the team. But by then, I started drinking quite a bit. And we had beer company up there called Rheingold's, a local beer. They were our sponsors on TV, and they had told us that we don't want you buying any beer. We'll send some out to your house every week, at least two cases. If you run out, we'll send you more. So they were sending beer out to our house, and so on the way home that day, I decided I better prepare my mother because, you know, it'd be beer in the icebox, and I'd probably be drinking. So I said, Mother, you know, I'm the lightest linebacker in professional football. Matter of fact, throughout the 14-game season, I have a tendency to lose weight. Matter of fact, the team would like me to keep my weight up. Matter of fact, they have suggested I might drink beer to keep my weight up. Mother didn't say anything. My dad had died, and he was a real disciplinarian in the family, so she didn't say a lot. We got on out to where we lived, and we had 8 football players that lived in 1 apartment development out there. And that day, Rheingold had delivered 16 cases of beer, 2 for all 8 people, and they'd stacked them in my foyer. The minute I opened that door, I looked at that, and Mother looked at that, and she said, "Son, how much weight they want you to gain?" And then we were playing the Chicago Bears one time, and old Dick Butt, because I'm sure y'all have heard how tough he is, he was playing linebacker over there, and our little wide receiver from Texas down here, from El Paso, Don Maynard, was going across the middle and catching some passes. We came up, and our offense went up and lined up. Old Butkus hollered over and told Maynard, he said, "Maynard, you come back across this middle and catch another pass, I'm going to bite your head off." Maynard looked at him and said, "Butkus, little squeaky," you know, Maynard weighed about 170 pounds, and little squeaky voice, West Texas voice, he said, "Butkus, if you bite my head off, you'll have more brains in your stomach than you got in your head." But I rocked along there at the Super Bowl, and 1972 came along. I was 35 years old. I played at pro football for 13 years. I played All-Star games 7 times, made All-Pro 7 times, and it became time for me to retire from pro football. And I went back home. I built a home down there. I married my childhood sweetheart. We had 2 kids. And I built a home, had it paid for. Got down there and got involved in all the community affairs, all the activities, trying to be a good citizen. And all at once, y'all, my life started going downhill really fast. I didn't have anything to hang on to. But you see, it couldn't be the alcohol, because alcohol was my friend. If alcohol was a solution to my problems, as I heard somebody else say. Alcohol was not a problem to me. I hung out with people that drank the way I drank. I hung out in places they served it the way I liked to serve. I hung out in places. The book talks about sordid places. I understand what they're talking about. But I couldn't get a job. I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't pay my bills. Wouldn't pay my bills. And everything I'd earned during football for those 13 years started to disappear. But you see, it still couldn't be the alcohol, because it was always my friend. I drank at the good times. I drank at the bad times. I drank all the times in between. And nobody could talk to me about my drinking. Well, certainly nobody that I was around and been to places and done the things that I'd done. My mother was the only person that could talk to me, and every now and then, after I'd embarrassed in that little hometown we was living in, you know, it don't take much to embarrass your folks in a town of 5,000 people. And I'd embarrass my mother and mow all at once. On Sunday morning, I'd hear a car pull up my driveway, and she'd blow that horn, and I'd look out there, and she'd give me this, and I'd go sit in that car, and she'd lecture me for about, till time for to go to church. You know, she always went to church. But she was the only one that could talk to me, the only one I'd put up with talking to me about my drinking. Times got really bad. You know, I became the town drunk in that hometown I grew up in. I'm not real proud of that. I'd rather talk about all the football exploits and all these other things, but I have to tell you all the truth. I became the town drunk. And finally, my wife, for 21 years, we've been married 21 years, and had those 2 beautiful kids. She filed for divorce in that hometown. And the reason she put on a divorce petition was chronic alcoholism. Well, I'm sure y'all know what my attitude was about that. Hell, that old girl wasn't even a college graduate. I might be an alcoholic, but I damn sure wasn't chronic, you know. That was 1980. In 1975, the people in the state of Mississippi asked me to quit driving on their streets and highways, and to ensure the fact that I might not drive on them, they took my driver's license. But I'd driven 5 years without it. See, when you got a Super Bowl ring and them cops like football, you don't really need a driver's license, because they'd stop you and I'd talk to them and show them that ring. We'd talk about football and they'd let me go, you know. But in 1980, after my wife filed for that divorce, there was a lot going on in my life besides not having a driver's license. You know, some people talk about a geographic cure. Well, I moved across the state line into Memphis, Tennessee, some 250 miles north, and I'm really not sure whether that was just a geographic cure or maybe it was unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Because a lot of things were happening in my life at that time. But I got up to Memphis, I figured out real quick they had the dumbest cops any place I'd ever been in my life. They'd stop me and I'd show them that ring and they said, no, took me to jail. Didn't understand that. Finally, after I was about 5 years sober, I figured it out. Memphis is a basketball town. If I'd have been a big basketball star up there, they'd have still let me go, you know, but I played football. They don't know a damn thing about football up there, so. But I started going to jail, and I tell you, you know, once you get arrestable, you keep doing what you're doing, the chances are it's going to keep happening. You know, I wish I had kept count of how many times I went to jail. Most times it was just DUI. Most times either DUI or public drunk and those kind of things, but you know, we might have a pension plan in Alcoholics Anonymous one of these days, and I might not even qualify because I don't know how many times I went to jail. But I went to jail a lot, and it gets easier. If you've only been one time, just keep on doing what you're doing and keep on going because it gets easier. It gets where you could live in jail. You know, it wasn't a big deal. And sure enough, when I moved to Memphis, I found another girl. You know, I was really attracted to this lady named Peggy because, you see, she had a car and a house and a job. And I was basically living off my wits. I called myself a manufacturer's representative. I had all the mechanics in place to do that, but I didn't have a damn thing to sell. And all that is a salesman. If you ain't got nothing to sell, you just don't make any money, but you don't get fired. I never got fired. But I own my own business, see? And so I set up some light housekeeping with Peggy there for a while, and then finally she got real sick with psoriasis and other things, and they said it was a lot of stress in her life, and she was about to figure out that it was me. And so I did what all good drunks do. I talked her into marrying me. You know, once you get that piece of paper, they can't just haul on and leave, you know. So we got married on September 20th, 1985. And I was still drinking, and my life was still in a mess. My drinking patterns were daily. I drank whatever I could get my hands on. You know, somebody talked about that choice being scotch. My choice was what anybody else would buy or what I could get my hands on. And I was telling Jess sometime over the weekend, you know, I could be totally broke, not have a penny to my name, give me two drinks, I could figure out how I could get all the booze in the world. I don't know whether that's a trait that most alcoholics have or not, but I know I had that ability. I might be passing a hot check that Peggy had to go pick up later, but some way I could always figure out how to get some booze. And I drank every day. That was my job. I hung out in places if I had money where they served it like I wanted to serve. Didn't I stay at home and drink? And I have drank cooking sherry whenever times got bad and I couldn't get down to get nothing else to drink. I drank either. Because I deserved it. I'd been places, done things nobody else had done. Didn't know a thing about not drinking. Didn't want to know nothing about not drinking. November of 1985, I wrecked Peggy's favorite car. It was her favorite because it was paid for. And I didn't have a car at the time. I'd been temporarily repossessed or something, you know, along those lines. And I totaled it. And I took the pledge. She got my son to come up there from college and get me out of jail. That was a humiliating experience when your son's trying to go to college and he's got to come up there and spend what money he's put up for college because his dad won't help him pay for college because he's drunk all the time and he come up there and bail me out of jail with his college money. And I took the pledge. I don't know where I put my hand on the Bible. Sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't have to. If things weren't real bad, I wouldn't put my hand on that Bible. But sometimes I put it on there if things were real, real bad. And I said, I'll never do it again. I'm quitting drinking. I'm through. And I was through. I was through till I took the next drink. That next drink, that first drink, always did so much for you. But it also did so much to you. So I was through drinking till I picked up that next drink. And that didn't last long because I always picked it up. But on May the 24th of 1986, it was Memorial Day weekend. Nothing unusual. My wife was going over to her folks in DeWitt, Arkansas for the weekend. She had to be back Monday because she was going to work. And I was supposed to go with her. But I conveniently didn't show up on time. I was out drinking. And she went on over there without me on Friday. Well, I drank. And I wish I could tell you how long I've been drinking. I wish I could tell you how long I've been drunk. I didn't keep many good records at that time. You know, the records I kept, you couldn't read my handwriting anyway. So I don't know. I just drank. I drank as long as I could stand it, and then I'd sober up or detox my body long enough to drink some more. When I had to have it, I had to have it. But she left and went to DeWitt, Arkansas that Friday, and of course, I didn't want to go because I couldn't drink over in front of her folks. I couldn't stop drinking over there. And that's short of notice, so I didn't go. And I was coming up Winchester Avenue there, which is a big street, Saturday afternoon. It was raining a little bit, nothing unusual. Wasn't raining hard enough for anything to happen. But some idiot up there in the left lane was trying to make an illegal left turn. Because they had a big sign that said, no left turn. And, you know, just because I didn't have a driver's license, had improper tags on my car, didn't have any insurance, all those things didn't matter. He was breaking the law. And everybody else stopped. There were four cars between me and him, and I didn't stop. And we had a five-car pileup. And, but see, you know, I'm smart enough. No, there was a sign up there that said no left turn. He was violating the law. Y'all think that football players are pretty dumb, probably, and that once we get out of college, all we can do is go on into pro football. I got news for you. You know, some people can go to college and come out and go into pro football and do well. Some people can go on to be rocket scientists or neurosurgeons and those kind of things if they wanted to. I mean, you know, they're pretty smart. For instance, we had these two guys coming back from New York one year at football season was headed to Texas. And Curly had a car, and old Berlin was with him, and so they were driving for a while. Curly got tired, and he decided to get in the back seat and take a nap and put Berlin up there driving the car. And Curly took a nap for a while and got up. He said, well, Berlin, where are we? Berlin's just driving away. He said, damn, if I know. He said, well, you're driving. You're supposed to know where we're at. He said, I don't know. Man, somewhere back there, I saw a sign that said, toodly-doo. Curly said, man, we was in Ohio last time right before I went to sleep. We was coming up on Ohio. Man, Berlin, you done got us lost. Man, Curly jumped over in the front seat and got the sleep out of his eyes. All at once he saw a sign that said, Toledo, Ohio. Toodly-doo, you know. So we could be rocket scientists or neurosurgeon, but most of us decide to go into football, you know. But that Saturday afternoon, after I'd hit that car, the cops came and they wanted to see a driver's license, and I showed them that ring. I said, no. Then they started talking to me about taking a test. I said, whoa, I don't do well on tests. I better not do that. So they carried me down to the drunk tank in Shelby County, drunk tank, one more time. And I'd been there before, and it was Saturday. I knew the ropes. They'd take your picture and take your fingerprints and put you in a drunk tank with the rest of the drunks. That's about the way it worked. And so the drunk tank was a big circular drunk tank and had a concrete seat that went all the way around it. And I got there early enough. You know, it ain't like the Holiday Inn. You ain't got to make a reservation. They take you down there. They got a place for you. And so they carried me down there, threw me in that drunk tank, and I grabbed me about 5 or 6 feet of that concrete seat and laid down and passed out. But when you drink the way I did, you don't go to sleep. You can't wake up. You ain't been asleep. You just kind of pass out and come to, you know, at intervals. And I passed out early. Early the next morning, I came to. And all at once, I was really attracted to about 5 or 6 people on the other side of the cell over there. They were in a circle, and they were talking, and they were smoking, and I'd run out of cigarettes the night before. So I was really attracted to them. I was going over there to bum me a cigarette. And on the way over, I decided I better tell them how dumb the cops were. They had an ex-National Football League linebacker in a drunk tank, and that ain't normally where we hang out, you know. And when they found out who they had, they probably going to let me go. And then I decided I better try to help those guys shape their life up because they were in jail. Didn't dawn on me I was in there with them, you know. Something about maybe I thought I was temporary and they were permanent or something. I was going to help them straighten up their life and, because you get a lot of free advice in jail. For those of y'all who hadn't been there in a while, you get a lot of free advice in jail. Everybody in there tells you how to beat your case. Hell, they can't get themselves out, but they tell you how you can beat yours, you know. Must all be lawyers. We must lock up all lawyers, you know. But I walked over that side of that cell that morning, and I bummed that cigarette. I stood there and I talked to them, told them about me and how dumb the cops were and who I was and how important I was. And when the cops found out who they had there, they were going to let me go. And then I started asking about their life because it looked like they needed some help. And they said the gist of their conversation was, we live on the streets of whatever town we happen to be in. We just happen to be in Memphis, Tennessee. And we either work long enough or steal enough to get a bottle of wine, and we drink it. We pass out in doorways, abandoned cars, and over passes where we have to be. But they also shared with me they're going to have to move out of Memphis, Tennessee. And I asked them why, and they said because Memphis got real tough on public drunk, being drunk in public, and that's all they were in jail for. And every time they turned around, they were going to jail, and they were going to jail too much, and they decided they'd go to Little Rock, Arkansas. I asked them how they'd get there. They said, we'll hitchhike. I said, how long will it take you? 10 days, 2 weeks. You know, I don't know what triggered my mind that morning, but I went back over and I sat down on that concrete seat I'd slept on the night before. And all at once, after talking to those people on the other side of that cell, you know, Little Rock, Arkansas is 135 miles from Memphis. Even then, I knew that. And I knew I had the ability most days of my life to drive over and back in one day if I wanted to. Although I had wrecked the only possession I had left that night before. It was one of them drunk cars. I don't know where y'all got them out here or not, but if you don't have a drunk car, I'll tell you about mine. It's about an 8-year-old Buick. It was a basic blue car. It had a green fender up here on the front, you know. The one on the right is trying to fall off, and baling wire, we tied the trunk and the hood down to keep it from flying. Well, y'all know, about a $100 car. That's what I'd wrecked the night before. But I knew I usually could go to Little Rock and drive back in one day if I needed to. And these people were talking about 10 days, 2 weeks to hitchhike over there. So something triggered my mind, and I sat down on that concrete seat. And all it was, my life flashed before my eyes like a VCR tape. I saw where I was as a child, all the hopes and ambitions and dreams I'd had coming out of high school. And then I saw how I'd gone to college, and after 4 years of college, I was totally untouched by a college education. And then I saw all the good things that happened to me in pro football and how we'd reached the pinnacle of success. You don't get no higher in pro football than playing and winning the Super Bowl. That's just as high as you can go, you know. And then for the first time in my life, I saw my life after football. For the first time in my life, I had the ability to put alcohol into my problems. The book calls it a moment of truth, a moment of clarity. I believe every alcoholic in this world has at least one shot at this moment of truth, this moment of clarity, where he can be honest. If he can be honest with himself, as was talked up here from behind this podium earlier about surrender and honesty and those kind of things, if he can be honest with himself, he has a shot at getting a hold of this thing and staying sober. But you know, once that happens and you know that alcohol ain't going to work for you anymore, and you know you're going to drink the minute you get out of jail, I knew that from the depth of my soul that I always had. Every time I got out of jail, I don't know what it is about jail, but it always made me thirsty. And when I got out, I knew I'd get out. You know, jail was a commonplace thing to me. So I really wasn't worried about it. But, I knew that all I wanted to do when I got out was take a shower and then, you know, my drinking. So I knew at the depth of my soul that I couldn't drink alcohol, but I knew I was going to drink alcohol. That's one predicament that I never want to be in again. Because no matter where you are, where you were, where you will be, when those things happen to you as they happen to me, and if you're an alcoholic by our nature, they will happen. You're going to have to probably do what I did. I got out of my jail, my knees in that jail cell, and I said that prayer, God help me. And I don't know what I expected. All of my grandiose ideas about life, I probably expected God, after that simple prayer, to zap himself doors with lightning and let me walk out of there a free man. But it didn't happen that way. I got a bail bondsman the next morning, got out, went home, told my wife, she had come home by that time, and I told her, I think I need some help. And she said those magic words. She said, Larry, if you need help, you'll find it. The phone book's full of people that can help you, but I can't help you. And isn't that the truth? Bill Wilson was on that journey out there in Akron, Ohio, when he had to go find Dr. Bob, or he had to drink himself, he felt like. He felt like he was either going to drink or he was going to talk to somebody. And that's the way Alcoholic Anonymous was formed, one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. And you see, my wife's not an alcoholic, so she couldn't help me. And she'd never been to Al-Anon a day in her life. She didn't know anything about it, even though she's got a black belt in it now. She didn't know anything about it then. But she said those words. If you need help, you'll find us. Phone books full of people that help you. Well, I didn't drink anything that Sunday afternoon after I got out of jail. I had a friend come get me out of jail. I didn't drink anything. I don't know where there's anything in the house to drink enough. All I know is I had withdrawals. I know that I sweated a lot, and I'd get cold, and I'd throw up, and then I'd shake, and all the stuff we go through, but I'm in pretty bad shape. My wife went on to work like her normal custom, and I called her at work, and I said, I don't guess you heard me. I think I need some help. You see, all the time, from the time I was that tall and being able to play football, all of my life, all I had to do was snap my fingers, and somebody came to my rescue. And I'm here to tell you all tonight, if I could snap my fingers that day, and a man, woman, dog, child, cat, whatever came to my rescue, y'all would have a different speaker up here tonight. Because everything had to fail me before I could get sober. And she said those magic words again after I talked to her. You need help, you'll find a phone book full of people that can help you. And then all at once, my mind clicked in, or my mind played a trick on me, or really, I know it was one of them God things. I had just... Eileen out at Louisiana used to talk about this God thing. She died a while back, but she was a super nice lady. And one of them God things happened. My mind gave me a telephone number from a treatment center in Brinkley, Arkansas. I'd never been to Brinkley, Arkansas in my life. I'd driven through there on Interstate 40. Never been there. And I don't know what y'all do if you're watching TV and they start talking about not drinking and you're drinking. And I had a clicker in my hand. I always went to another station. I didn't watch none of that. But I knew that phone number that morning as well as I knew my name. And I had sense enough to dial that phone. And I got a recovering alcoholic on the other end of the phone. He said, if you'll hang on to 2 o'clock this afternoon, we'll be in your living room, and I'll bring another alcoholic with me. I hung on 2 o'clock that afternoon. They came in my living room, and in a short period of time, they pissed me off. They started telling me how they used to drink. I didn't care how they used to drink. I probably could drink both of them on the table. Then after a period of time, they started talking about how they stay sober. Somewhere in this feeble mind, the book talks about a program of attraction. And I was attracted to these guys because they knew about drinking, and I knew about drinking. And everybody in this room that's an alcoholic knows about drinking. It ain't no need for me to get up here and tell you about drinking. Because y'all can drink. But they knew about staying sober, and I didn't have a clue about staying sober. I didn't have, not the first. You see, anytime anybody mentioned anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or any other way to stay sober, I had what back of the big book calls contempt prior to investigation will leave us in everlasting ignorance. And that's what I had. But I wasn't even thinking about getting sober. So I was attracted to those people, and I packed my little bag, and I went back to Brinkley, Arkansas with them, didn't know nothing about what was going on. Got over there, and it's a 14-day detox program. That's all it was. All they do is detox off alcohol, and every spare moment we had when we weren't taking up with trying to stay or get detoxed, we had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we started studying it and reading it. But there was one guy over there, he's got the same initials as mine, Larry G., and he saved my life, this big black man. Because you know what he did? He told me the truth. He didn't sugarcoat anything. He said, I got sober in the Little Rock Approach Plan. I don't know how many people here have heard of the Little Rock Approach Plan, but it was a tough, tough program from what I hear, a way to get sober. And he shared with me what it took for him to get sober, stay sober. And he said, I had to read and study the book because this is a textbook that's already been mentioned up here. You know, I learned one thing in high school or college somewhere along the way. I love to read novels, but once I read a novel, all I need to do, I can remember the story and I put it up on the shelf. But a textbook, I've got to study. You know, here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we say turn to chapter 5, find how it works, or read how it works. I don't believe you can do that unless you've read those first 4 chapters, including the doctor's opinion, because if I went into a math class and I'd never had any addition and subtraction, and they said, we're going to turn today to chapter 5, we're going to do long division. I'd have to do what I used to, and I'd skate out there and go AWL for a classroom, you know. But I couldn't do it. But here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what we do, and I think we need to read and study the entire book. But he told me I'm going to have to read and study. And I didn't like read and study. I don't like them words, but that's what I had to do. Then he told me I had to get a home group. Because, see, when you're about to die, when you're about to go get that drink, Your home group, if you've been there enough and they know enough about you, they know those symptoms. And he told me I had to get a sponsor. So I got out of there 14 days, went back to Memphis, Tennessee, and I started going to meetings in Southwest Memphis. And those people made me so welcome. They had some old-timers in that group, and they knew exactly how to handle me. They told me they were going to make me their group football expert. And when they got ready to talk about football, they was going to call on me. Went there a lot of years, and they ain't never talked about football. And then of all things, they assigned me a sponsor. He's my sponsor today. He's got 27 years. I'm not recommending that's the best way to get a sponsor, but they assigned me one, and it's really what every big macho football player needs. He sells wholesale flowers, and he's about that tall. And he would eat up with all our sayings, you know, first things first, and how important is it, and there's 2,000 Chinese over there, 2 billion Chinese over there that don't know a damn thing about your little old problems and don't even care. All those catchy things, you know. And then they kept on, you know, and I got those first three steps down pretty tight because I believe you get those when you get here. I believe that you accept those steps. I don't think you can hardly sit down and work them if you hadn't surrendered to the fact that you can't drink alcohol. I don't think anybody in the world convinced you that those first three steps are important. But you know, we started talking about that fourth step. I showed them my Super Bowl ring, and they said, no. Still got to do that fourth step. But you see, I had surrendered that first step, because that's another thing that Larry G over at that little detox place told me. You're going to have to surrender to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic. That's the first step in recovery. And that's words out of the book. And I didn't know anything about surrender. You see, I was raised by a family that told me I could be anything or do anything as long as I worked hard enough or sacrificed enough or gave up enough stuff. I could do anything I wanted to do in life. And I didn't think I'd ever had surrender to anything or anybody. And this Larry G kept telling me, he said, you may have to compare it to something that happened in your life because you may want it close to where you can remember it. And, you know, we have a tendency to forget things. I said, you really need to remember this stuff about surrendering to the fact you can't drink alcohol. And boy, I tell you, I did a lot of long thought process about it, trying to figure it out and researched it. And, you know, at times on Sunday afternoon, they'd shoot the gun and the game would be over with, and we'd look up there on the scoreboard and the score would read, them 48, us 10. We'd go in the locker room and we'd say, well, we just kind of ran out of time today. Hell, if we hadn't run out of time, it'd been 100-10. But we couldn't surrender, see, we had to play the next week, so we didn't even talk about surrender. But I did a lot of thought process about it, and finally I realized there was one time in my life that I had surrendered. The Miami Dolphins had this fullback named Larry Zonka. His jersey number was 39. If you don't believe it, I'll show it to you. It's tattooed on my chest, where he ran over me so damn many times. I played linebacker, and he played fullback, and every time he got the ball, I was supposed to tackle him, and every time I tackled him, he ran over me and hurt me. Just that simple. They had him listed in the program at 235 pounds. I know his right leg weighed 235 pounds. I don't know what his total body weight was. Finally, in 1971, we went to an All-Star game in Houston, Texas. We were going to work out all week, and then the East team that Larry Zonka and I was both on, we're going to play the West team on the following Sunday in the All-Star game. And somewhere or other, we got out there, and they put he and I in a room together for a week. We got to be roommates. And we drank and played cards and chased women. And, well, no, we didn't catch none of them women. We chased them. And finally, at the end of the week, you know, I made up my mind he was just a good, tough, Polak football player. Just asked no quarter and gave none. And just really tough. And so he wanted his wife and my wife to get to know each other, so he flew his wife out to Houston, Texas to the All-Star game, and I flew my wife and kids out there, and we got them tickets together in the stands, and they sat there, and they got to be friends. The very next year, we're playing the Dolphins down in the Orange Bowl in September, one of their home games. We travel down there. Old Bob Greaves is a quarterback, and he goes back to throw pass. I'm at linebacker, and we're playing a zone defense, and I get back there 15 yards deep, looking forward, seeing everything happening in front of me. Soccer comes out on a little circle pattern over on my side. Our big old defensive ends are on top of Greasy. He's 6'7", and when he puts his hands up, it's like they call it throwing out of a well. Greasy's trying to throw the ball up over Verlin's arms and get it out there to Zonka. Zonka's looking back over his head like this, running straight at me. I'm running straight at him. I got a 15-yard running start. I'm going to tattoo his ass. It's going to be payback for all them times he ran over me and hurt me because he is totally defenseless. He's looking back over his head, and I'm coming head on. I arrived just as the ball touched his fingertips, and I hit him right there with that helmet as hard as I've ever hit a human being in my life. We fell down the ground in a pile up, and the ball went off over as an incompleted pass. I want to tell you all, I was hurting from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. I'd give him my best shot. I called him defenseless. And normally when you did that, they'd have to come get him on a stretcher. So I kind of peeped up to see where the stretcher was coming from. I didn't see no stretcher. I felt a movement in that pile up there by me, and I heard this voice say, "Larry, how's your wife and family?" I surrendered to Larry Zonka right then. If he came in that door right over here, I'd make y'all a new door right here. Because I have stayed surrendered to Larry Zonka. But isn't that the way it is with alcohol? You know, we surrender one day, and the next day we take it all back, start all over again. We got to stay surrendered to the fact that we can't drink alcohol. You know, my life since I've been sober has been unbelievable. My credit and everything was so messed up. I owed the IRS a ton of money when I got sober. I hadn't filed income taxes 5 straight years. I didn't think ex-pro football players need to file income taxes. I didn't make no money much anyway, but what little you made, I hadn't filed anything on it, and they kind of frowned on that, so I owed them a bunch of money plus penalty plus interest. I owed a big debt down in Mississippi on some land, some bogus land deals. And then I had to make amends to my brother. You see, my brother was born club-footed. He's 2 years younger than I am, and his foot was turned completely around. He had his toes turned backwards. Through a series of operations from the time he was 6 weeks old, they broke his foot, kept turning around, keeping him in a cast. He stayed in a cast for the first 6 years of his life. And so consequently, one leg was smaller than the other. But he played high school sports. And he was good, pretty good, decent baseball player, football player. And so when I was at Ole Miss, he's 2 years behind me, so I was in my glory years at Ole Miss. And back in those days, they had kind of unlimited scholarships. And I demanded that they give him a scholarship for him to come up there and play baseball. Well, they gave him a scholarship, and he came up there, but he didn't have the kind of free ride I had. You see, I thought I was an all-star, and they gave me everything, books, tuition, everything. All he got was a room behind the gymnasium. He got to work in the serving line at the cafeteria. He had to scrounge around to buy his own books, but he made it. He went through school, and he got a four-year education, and he's CPA. And I'm sure you know the rest of the story. Well, my finances got so bad off that I didn't have any money. I went to him with some kind of bogus deal, and I got his money involved with a little bit of my money and lost it all, and consequently, or lived on his, really, is what I did, drank on it for a long time. And so when I got sober, I owed him a ton of money, too. And when I wrote that fourth step, and my sponsor sat there and looked at that, what I'd written, he said, "What you going to do about your brother?" You see, in this mind, I had it figured out where I'd help him get his college education. That was kind of balance them books. And my sponsor said, "No. Don't work that way. You wrote it down on that piece of paper. It's bothering you." And he told me the exact words to say to my brother. He drove me 245 miles to where my brother lived because I still didn't have a driver's license. And he drove me down there, and he told me exactly what to say to my brother and that I had to make amends. You see, my book says two different types of amends. My book says direct amends. That's face-to-face wherever possible. And then it says complete amends. And that means complete amends. If you give an old man $100, you pay him $100. You don't pay him $95 and call it slick. You've got to set the record straight through direct amends and complete amends. And that's what my sponsor taught me. And today I can go to family reunions and I can look my brother and I because I did what I was supposed to do. I had to go to my wife after I got sober. I married her for all the wrong reasons. As I told you, I was attracted to her because she had a house and car and a job and money in the bank. And I wasn't any better husband for the first 2 years I was sober than I was when I was free. I overdosed in Vegas. I fell in love with these rooms, and it was a good place to hide out, too. You know, you can hide from life in these rooms. I try not to let the people I sponsor today do that. But you can come to these rooms and stay in these rooms so much that you don't work, that you don't provide for your family. And that's what I was doing for the first 2 years I was sober. It wasn't any better for her than me being drunk. I just didn't spend quite as much money. I went to her 2 years sober and told her, I said, Peggy, you know, that I know it hadn't been any better for you. And I was willing to start from this day forward. And I'll work at this relationship, you see, because I'd always taken hostages before. I'd never worked at any relationship in my life. If you wanted to go with me and do the things I was doing to be part of my life, that's okay. The minute you wanted out, there was a road. You could hit the road. I didn't care. And I'd run over a lot of people in the meantime. And so I told her that we'd start from that day forward. And today, you know, she knows all my secrets. She knows everything about her. We're best friends. She's grandmother to 8 beautiful grandkids. I got one named James Larry Grantham III. I'm watching him already. He ain't even 6. But I'm sure he's going to have them tennis that he's around her. But life is good. Life's what I make it. There's been some things going on in my life recently. I've been self-employed and now through a certain series of changes, it looks like I'm merging my business with a guy from Alabama. And, you know, there's fear involved. Yes, and I've talked about it most of the weekend. You know, anytime change comes in your life, there's fear. And you just have to deal with this fear. And the Alcoholic Anonymous has taught me how to do that. You know, I love these rooms of Alcoholic Anonymous. I love people all over the world, all over the United States that I've been able to meet through this program of Alcoholic Anonymous. You know, they treat you like somebody. Can you believe that? You come off these retreats, you know, these conferences, and they treat you like you're really something special. You know, we're just doing, you know, I told my mother one time, I said, Mom, I got 5 years to write. She said, Son, I got 75 years. There was a man down in Olive Branch, Mississippi. He died a few years back. Had he not died in March, he would have had 40 years in October. Mr. Franklin Williams, he called himself the Pope from Olive Branch. And he was one of my dear, dear friends, and he meant an awful lot to me. I went to see Mr. Franklin before he died in the hospital, and they had blood pressure problems, low blood pressure, and he couldn't lift his head up. So he pulled my ear down there close to his voice and to his lips, and he said, Larry, don't you ever forget where you came from. Don't ever forget where your help comes from. So after Mr. Franklin died, Mr. Franklin always closed his talks with a football story. Go out and play many, many tapes and try to take it down by hand and try to figure out this football story that Mr. Franklin closed his tapes with. Well, in 1994, it became necessary for us to move out of Memphis, Tennessee, where we lived there. It got kind of in a bad area, and we wanted to buy a house, so we went down to Mississippi and bought a house. And I went over to Olive Branch, Mississippi, and I rented me an office space. And I went in and paid my office rent every month to my landlord from my office. And all at once, one day, I went in there, and up on the wall, he had a plaque. And he swore to me he'd been there ever since I'd been coming in there. But on the plaque, it was called The Rules of the Game. And it was the exact closing that Franklin Williams had used in all of his talks that he'd made to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I want to close that tonight. And the name of it is The Rules of the Game. And y'all can tell I still hadn't memorized. Mr. Franklin was far ahead of me, you know, it's unbelievable. But it says, The Rules of the Game. It says, Son, I'm giving you the ball. I'm naming you the quarterback for your team in the game of life. I'm your coach, but I'm going to give it to you straight. There's only one schedule to play. It lasts all your life. But it consists of only one game. It's long, no timeouts, and no substitutions. You play the whole game all your life. Now, you'll have a great backfield. You're calling the signals. You'll be the quarterback. But the other three fellows in the backfield with you have great reputations. They are named Faith, Hope, and Charity. You'll work behind a truly powerful line. End to end, it consists of honesty, loyalty, devotion to duty, self-respect, spirit of cleanliness, good behavior, and courage. Now the goalpost is the gates of heaven. God is the referee and sole official. He makes all the rules, and there's no appeal from them. There are 10 additional rules. You'll know them as the 10 commandments, and you'll play them strictly in accordance with your own spiritual experience. There's also an important ground rule. It is, as ye would that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. Now here's the ball. It's your immortal soul. Hold on to it. Now son, get in there and play ball. God bless everybody here tonight. I love you. Thank you.